Jake Jones versus Commonwealth. And I would ask all of you that are on speakerphone to pick up your handset so we can hear a little more clearly.
Yes, sir.
And with that being said, Mr. Grimes, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. 3 minutes.
All right. You may begin when ready.
May it please the court and counsel, of course, my name is Terry Grimes. I represent Jake Jones, the appellant slash defendant in this case. This is an appeal of a final order of judgment from the Circuit Court of the County of Roanoke in a criminal case.
Mr. Grimes, let me stop you there because I have a question about that statement. You say this is a final order. However, the order specifically takes the issue of restitution under advisement and does not resolve that. Now, 19.2-305.1 requires a plan of restitution in any sentence in which a, or any conviction in which a sentence is suspended. So my question is this really a final order?
I raised that very point with the trial court. Whether it was a final order, the trial court was of the view that restitution, fixing restitution, was an ancillary proceeding and that the order was final.
Well, how do we decide it? We have jurisdiction over a final conviction in a circuit court. If restitution has not been made and the statute requires it, how could that be final?
Well, I mean, that's a good point, and I raised it with the trial court. All I can tell you is the trial court maintained that it was final, and so you're right. There was what was called an ancillary proceeding for the purpose of fixing restitution. That's all true. Yep.
All right. It's the best you can do.
That's the best I can do, yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Turning back to the issues, there are two issues in this appeal. Incidentally, I look forward to some instruction from the court with respect to that point, for at least for future cases. But back to the issues. The first question is, I'll call it a jurisdictional or constitutional issue, and the other is an evidentiary question. Very briefly, Jones was tried and convicted of grand larceny at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's case in chief, and again at the conclusion of all the evidence. Jones moved to strike the evidence on the grounds that it was not sufficient to sustain a conviction for grand larceny. At the conclusion of all the evidence, the trial court agreed, but then reduced, I put that word in quotes, reduced the felony charge to misdemeanor interference with the property rights of another. In our view, that was error, because interference with the property rights of another is not a lesser included offense of grand larceny. I think that point is not in contention on this appeal, and the Commonwealth didn't argue to the contrary, but says that our objection was not preserved for a number of reasons, and we disagree, obviously. You've read the briefs. But even if we're wrong, even if the objection was inadequate, this court, may review the error for good cause or to meet the ends of justice.
In its brief, the Commonwealth asserts that our ability or lack of ability to reach the issue is governed by this court's en banc decision in Edwards. In your reply brief, you didn't indicate how you thought this case was different. How would you describe
it? Your Honor, you're breaking up there. I heard Edwards, and that's the last thing I heard.
How would you distinguish your case from Edwards?
We failed to do that in our reply brief, Your Honor. I don't have an answer here. I don't have an answer for you. We didn't do that in Edwards. We didn't address Edwards in our reply brief, and so, again, that's my error.
Well, if you have an argument now, I'd like to hear it.
Well, in our view, once the court sustained the motion to strike and agreed that the evidence was not sufficient, the case was over, there was nothing to do except the ministerial act of entering a final order of judgment. And here, in our view, Jones was convicted of something with which he was never charged, which, if true, obviously violates the state and federal constitutions as well as the criminal procedure in Code Section 19.2. So that's our argument with respect to that particular point, is that the court lost jurisdiction when it sustained the motion to strike. If the court agrees with us with respect to that this first issue, then obviously the case is over. The court would dismiss and enter final judgment for the defendant. That's the what we call the jurisdictional or constitutional issue. The second issue is an evidentiary one. Also, we see it as an easy call, and there the trial court erred by admitting into evidence a jail recording of a conversation between Les Boston and his mother. During that conversation, Boston told his mother that Jones did not have permission to borrow the climbing gear and saws. We objected on grounds that that was hearsay and because the evidence was offered to bolster the credibility of the witness. And again, the Commonwealth concedes that the admission of the evidence was error, but says the objection was imprecise. I mean, I've got the transcript. We objected on grounds of hearsay and bolstering, and in our view, it should not have been admitted. If the court agrees with that particular point, then you wouldn't necessarily enter a final order that would require that the case be remanded and retried. So that's our argument with respect to those particular issues.
Mr. Grounds, let me ask you about that, your last comment. If we disagree with you on the first issue and say that, the objection was not preserved to conviction of a non-lesser-included offense, but we agree with you on the second issue that the evidence was hearsay and should not have been admitted, what would we remand this case back to the trial court for? Would we remand it back for trial under the interfering with property rights conviction? Would we how would we handle that?
Well, point well taken. Point well taken.
What's your point in response?
Yes. Well, no, I don't think you could remand it for a trial on interference with the property rights of another because he's never been charged with that offense. He wasn't directly indicted. There's no warrant, no summons, no nothing charging him with that. So you sort of talk me into the position I want to take in that there's nothing to do. It seems to me you have to sustain the first point. But if you don't, for whatever reason, yeah, what would you remand that for? For trial on what charge? Because the court's already said the evidence is not sufficient to sustain conviction for grand larceny, and he hasn't been charged with interference. So how then would the trial court proceed? And I think that's...
Your response is that the grand larceny trial could not go forward based on double jeopardy concerns, and that the interference with property case could not go forward because that judgment was a nullity because the court did not have the ability to do it.
That's a better argument than I made, Your Honor. And I can't disagree with you.
Could the Commonwealth indict on the interference with property crimes since it's not a lesser included offense?
I would say no on double jeopardy grounds.
But doesn't that take us in a circular make a circular argument if the conviction on the interference with property is a nullity? My understanding of the case law would suggest that that case never existed, which would then give the government the ability to try the case under that theory if they chose to do so.
Yeah, and that right. It is right. There are problems with the argument. I see your point, and I can't disagree with it. If that case never existed, if he's never been charged with it, I mean, maybe he has a Section 1983 claim. That's a civil matter. That's not before this court, though, for being convicted of something he was never charged with. But that's a due process issue. But with respect to our criminal process, that's just a point well taken. If he, I guess he could be tried for interference or whatever else the warrant or the evidence would support, whatever probable cause would support. I can't disagree with that.
Let me go back to your first issue, and particularly on the preservation. It seems to me that Rule 5A18 is a rule in place to ensure that the trial court is not sandbagged, that the trial court gets an opportunity to address the issue before you assign error to it. Now, it, it's seems to me in this case that your client received a lot of benefit from the ruling of the trial court. A felony was reduced to a misdemeanor. So I could understand why you might not want to object to that at the time. But doesn't it seem a little bit unfair to use the most appropriate term, for you to receive the benefit of the trial court's action in the trial court and then attempt to get more benefit on appeal?
I wouldn't see it as unfair, Your Honor. To me, this is a constitutional issue. And we cited a case on brief where the court raised the issue itself on one occasion, and if interference is not a lesser-included offense, then he never should have been convicted of it. He was never. So I see it as a constitutional issue for all the reasons stated. And let me also tell the court that though it's not in the appendix, we did raise this very issue with the trial court at this the second hearing on October 11, 2016, where the court fixed restitution. While the matter was still within the breast of the court, or maybe not if it's an ancillary proceeding, which is what the trial court said.
Well, if it's a final order, the court lost any jurisdiction to even modify that order 21 days after May 16th.
Made that objection too at the ancillary proceeding, which we didn't sign any of that as error in this case. But yeah, we raised that on October 11, 2016. That's in the record, not in the joint appendix before you.
But again, back to your argument. You say that this is a constitutional issue.
Yes.
Because he was never charged. But you can waive a constitutional issue by failing to present it to the trial court. So
well,
why wouldn't we, you know, do that? Double jeopardy, for instance, if you don't raise double jeopardy in the trial court, it's deemed waived, and we would never address it on appeal.
Yeah, right. But the way this case evolved or went down, the court sustained the motion to strike the evidence, agreeing that the evidence was insufficient to convict him of grand larceny. Again, in our view, the case was over. There was nothing left to do but enter final order. Look, the trial court convicted him of interference, but it could have been whatever, and this is nonsensical, but it could have been murder, it could have been robbery, it could have been possession, whatever, that he was never charged with.
You're into your rebuttal, Mr. Grimes. I just wanted to alert you to that.
Yes, sir. Then I will stop.
All right. Mr. Katz?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. If I could begin, I would like to take up the defendant's, what he's termed, a jurisdictional argument. And again, I think Edwards is clear.
Mr. Katz, before you get going on that, can you answer Judge Petty's very first question about the fact that there is a restitution issue still outstanding in the trial court? Do we indeed have a final order here?
Well, I suppose I would respond to it in this fashion. The trial court has determined that, in its estimation, that is a final order, and there's not been an assignment of error as to that ruling. And so I think it comes before this court in the style
of the rules require. Don't the rules require us to only adjudicate matters in which final orders or other specialized circumstances exist? If we don't have a final order, no matter what the trial court may have thought it did, aren't we kind of stuck?
Well, I think implicit in that finding is the court's estimation that as for the sentence and the conviction, that would remain constant regardless of whatever else happened with regard to restitution, which the trial court deemed ancillary.
But we only have jurisdiction to hear appeals from final orders. That is conveyed to us by statute. The trial court can't convey jurisdiction by deeming it a final order if, in fact, it's not.
Well, and I certainly understand that, Your Honor. I think the only response I can give you is whatever else was intended to happen with regard to restitution, the trial court conveyed by virtue of its finding that the sentence and the conviction would not change, and so that's why it deemed it ancillary. And I certainly understand the court's position and the threshold question.
I take it Mr. Katz has no position on that. It's leaving our determination of our jurisdiction up to us.
Yes, well said, Your Honor. And you know, had this been highlighted as an issue, perhaps I would have a better response, but it was certainly not raised on brief, and there was no assignment of error to that basis. I apologize that I don't have a fuller answer for you, but I would take no position and defer to the court as to that issue. With that, I'm happy to move on to the jurisdictional issue or answer additional questions if the court may have any.
Why don't you go on to the merits here?
Thank you, Your Honor. So with respect to what the defendant has termed the jurisdictional question, I would submit that Edwards makes clear it is not jurisdictional, that there is a distinction between a trial court's authority and its jurisdiction that's been resolved. And as Your Honor, Judge Petty pointed out, you can certainly waive whatever constitutional argument the defendant maintains he has, and he's not preserved that. Yes, Your Honor.
Are we in a different position than Edwards, though? Because Edwards makes clear that although 5A18 allows exceptions for good cause or to meet the ends of justice, that Edwards did not invoke those exceptions, and the court says in its opinion, we won't raise them sua sponte. Here, albeit only in the reply brief, appellant has raised Rule 5A18, has he not?
Certainly, Your Honor, and I think in terms of analyzing whether the ends of justice exception applies, I find useful this court's opinion in Brittle, that's at 54 Virginia App 505, a case from this court in 2009. And as one looks at the ends of justice exception, this court highlights the applicable jurisprudence, noting that the Supreme Court has limited its application to cases where the judgment of the trial court was error and the application of the exception is necessary to avoid a grave injustice or denial of essential rights.
But what didn't we in Jimenez, or I saw the Supreme Court, I guess, in Jimenez, say that the ends of justice are appropriate where the record affirmatively establishes the defendant has been, the Commonwealth has not proven an element of offense, element of the offense does not exist, I guess is a better way of phrasing it.
Certainly, and that is tied up in sort of the either the element is essential element is missing, or there is a legal impossibility of being convicted of, you know, in essence, they've been convicted of something that's not a crime. And here, what I would submit is the finding of the trial court, regardless of any error that might have occurred in its path to getting to a conviction under 18.2.121, has not omitted an essential element. At least the record doesn't demonstrate that, and it certainly is a crime. It's not a legal impossibility to be convicted under 18.2.121. The only issue is whether the trial court got to that point appropriately, and that's not a question for the ends of justice exception. That's a standard, you know, error question that's capable of being waived, and it's certainly not a manifest injustice. So my submission would be, in reviewing the jurisprudence as Priddle does, it's clear that the ends of justice exception should not apply. This is not a situation where he was convicted of a non-offense, and he's waived whatever argument he might have about how the court arrived at that conclusion. If there are no additional questions on that, I'm sorry. If there are no additional questions on that basis, I would like to turn to the evidentiary question. And I think I would direct the court to 86 through 89 of the joint appendix. That is the discussion of the admissibility of these recordings. The first objection made by the defendant is to relevance. In response to that, the prosecution argues that the credibility has been put into question, and then on page 88, the response is that it's hearsay.
Well, isn't it hearsay? Isn't that a valid objection?
It is, but there is an exception to hearsay.
Wouldn't it be the Commonwealth's responsibility, the proponent of the testimony, to show why that exception applies? It's not the obligation of the defendant to knock down the proposed reason it's admissible.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but I think the way I read the record, it's you've got the Commonwealth asserting an exception to the hearsay rule, and then you have a general assertion that it's hearsay, and there is an argument about why the exception does not apply. So the last thing the trial court is presented with is an exception to the hearsay rule, and there's no argument explaining, well, Your Honor, that simply doesn't apply. You can't rely on that. So the trial court does not get the benefit of any argument explaining why that exception is not valid.
Don't we presume the trial court knows the law?
Well, that is a valid presumption, and it's certainly applicable, Your Honor, but I would submit that if one were to assign error to the trial court's ruling, it's necessary to point one's finger on why the trial court is wrong, and the trial court, this record simply doesn't indicate the trial court had the benefit of that argument.
Mr. Katz, is it the Commonwealth's position that there is a difference in kind between an objection hearsay to objection hearsay not within any exception, or are those equivalent?
No, that would certainly be the Commonwealth's position, and I would submit it's akin to Edwards, where the determination of this court is, you know, having a specific objection on one point is different than a specific objection on another point, or in this case, a general objection that it's hearsay.
Here, the reason that it wouldn't be admissible is that it is in fact hearsay. I mean, the stated reason is the reason it's not, I mean, and you concede that it is, in fact, an admissible hearsay, correct?
I do, but I think it's significant, and what's missing from the equation as you propose it is that the last thing the trial court hears is, well, there's a valid exception. And so if the purpose of the contemporaneous objection rule is to put the trial court on notice that it is erring, the trial court didn't get the benefit of that rule.
I never withdraw my hearsay objection. Isn't that the equivalent of saying it's not within the exception?
Well, I would submit that there is a difference, particularly where it is claimed there is a valid exception. You can't simply rely on the general assertion if a response embraces a specific exception.
Mr. Katz, I'm not sure that the Commonwealth attorney really enunciated the exception to the hearsay rule. He never referred to rule 2:801. He never said prior consistent statement. He just mumbled something about the defendant's credibility. So how is the defense attorney supposed to know exactly what exception he's relying on?
I certainly understand Your Honor's reticence to accept the argument that was put forward. I think the only response is it is clear he is relying on an effort to rehabilitate credibility, which has been called into question. And that,
I would say, doesn't that whole thing take us in a circle? There's an acknowledgement that it's hearsay. The Commonwealth does nothing to perfect or come up with a hearsay exception, but you're suggesting that it is the defendant's responsibility to perfect the objection that the Commonwealth hasn't identified an exception to. Isn't that sort of circular?
I would only submit, Your Honor, that I think the Commonwealth put its finger on the exception it was relying on with sufficient specificity.
Well, on page 89, the Commonwealth said it's a business record. And then the court said, I'm satisfied it comes in.
I certainly can't make the record any cleaner than it appears. There was a lot of argument being made, and some of it was direct, and some of it was erroneous. But I would simply take the position that if one makes a general hearsay objection, and the response to that is to cite however obliquely an exception to that rule, the trial court needs to get the benefit of the argument that explains why it can't rely on that rule. And I certainly understand this court's position, and this record may not be sufficient to make that argument count, but I think that's the best position I could take.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Grimes. If we agree with you on the first issue but disagree with you on the second and reverse, we would remand. What would we remand it for?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think implicit in that finding would be the notion that however infirm the conviction on 18.2.121 was, whatever objections were not preserved. I mean, if the court is denying the assignment of error on that ground, that's implicit in that finding. And so I think the court would remand for retrial on 18.2.121, that conviction, however erroneously the court arrived at it, would stand, and then they'd have the opportunity to retry to address the error in.
Would they be able to retry? Would they have the ability to retry, or have the ability to recharge?
Well, I think if your conclusion is that it was not error to convict him, it would be retrial. I don't think they could recharge for grand larceny. I think that would raise
no. Difference. I'm talking about the lesser offense.
I think it would be retrial on that ground, that the court would conclude that any assignment of error related to the validity of the conviction was not persuasive, but there was this evidentiary issue, and so we would start anew with a trial on that basis. I think that's the best answer I could give the court.
The Commonwealth's position is that he has forever waived the requirement that he, whether by direct indictment or summons, receive notice of that particular charge.
That would be the Commonwealth's position, that any argument in that regard was waived, and that the matter would begin. I guess I would be. You do raise an interesting question. So the indictment as it exists would charge an offense that can't be proceeded on. So perhaps the better position would be that it should be recharged. That the retrial could not proceed apace with the indictment in its current state, alleging a grand larceny.
The offense for which he was convicted is essentially a trespass offense. It's interfering with the real property rights of the defendant. The victim, which
yes.
is something that under these facts might be a little difficult to prove.
Understandably, but I think. Best course would be to recharge for that offense, and I will again defer to the court. I don't think there's an easy answer to that question, but I think that would be the best answer, would be to recharge.
Right.
With that, I would rely on my brief, and I'll happily answer any additional questions the court may have. I don't have further argument.
Hoping that there are none, I guess, would be the last part that you're saying implicitly.
Always happy to take questions from the court.
Thank you, Mr. Kett. Mr. Grimes, you've got your rebuttal time left.
Well, gentlemen, this is not merely an appeal. This is a law school exam, apparently. I mean, in all seriousness, this relatively pedestrian grand larceny case presents some very interesting issues. With respect to the constitutional issue and the point about waiver, I want to point out that in my view, this is not like, a failed motion to suppress, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, or a speedy trial waiver or something. This is different. This is the fact that he was convicted of something with which he was never charged. And I'm just thankful it wasn't murder, I guess. And again, I say that tongue-in-cheek, but not really, because he was never charged with interference with the property rights of another. I think you could address that issue sua sponte if you chose to do so. But I leave that to your good judgment. I'll be happy to answer. And with respect to the evidentiary question, it's obvious. It's obviously error, and what you do with it, we just await the judgment of the appellate court, and thank you for your time in this most interesting, engaging argument.
Thank you very much, Mr. Grimes. Mr. Katz, we thank you for your argument. We will conclude the hearing, adjourn the case, and reconvene in conference. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.